Okay, welcome to Power Play. As you heard, we were just listening to the first ministers of finance and health lamenting the fact that after a day of negotiations, no deal on health care, a bit of a sweetened offer put on the table today, would have added $11 billion in targeted funding to the pot. Not good enough for the provinces, so they are saying no deal, and a very disappointed Finance Minister Bill Morneau. So let's get a little bit of a strategic interpretation on this. So we're joined by our very prestigious group of strategists, minus the traveling Robin Sears. Lindsay Doyle toils for Summa Strategies, so does Michelle Austin, and Earnscliff's Greg Weston joins us to round up the table. Lindsay, you know Liberal politics. I was quite surprised to see the Ontario finance minister coming out swinging pretty hard at the Liberal government, sort of talking about, you know, they didn't give us the opportunity to negotiate, they rushed us and all this sort of stuff. Pretty interesting, though. What do you make of it?
I think they did what they have to do. You know, they're 18 months away from a provincial election, and they've got some pretty low ratings and some challenges within their own backyard. So it's important for them to be seen, I think, by their constituents and their voters, standing up for healthcare, which is the number one issue in the province of Ontario. I think also Ontario has the most to lose when it comes to, you know, moving back to a 3 or 3.5% transfer, because it does have the biggest population. It does have, you know, those who are aging the fastest. And so when it comes to fiscal challenges in the future, healthcare is going to be the top of that list for the province.
Something that looks, Stephen Harper looks like he had the right idea when he just said, I'm imposing it and walking away. He did 6% escalator for 5 years or 4 years there, Michelle. But, you know, where's the province's bargaining chip on this one? Can they actually fight the feds on this?
Well, I think that the provinces have wisely stuck together on this, which is really quite interesting for the first time in a long time. Nobody has come out, maybe with the exception of Ontario. And I think that the Ontario also, you have to remember, is, as Lindsay said, coming towards an election. And one great time-honored strategy is to rally against Ottawa, right? Oh, it's not our fault. Ottawa did it to us. So, you know, I think that the Harper government was wise not to meet with the provinces in retrospect, especially on a difficult issue like this, but still ponied up the money, which now some provinces are saying is a better deal.
Yeah, Greg, it seemed to me it wasn't a bad deal, but the feds were offering, but provinces saw it quite differently. I guess this proves sometimes you just can't negotiate with the herd of cats.
Well, the pardon me, a previous prime minister by the name of Pierre Elliott Trudeau famously said in the middle of one of these cat fights, a reporter asked him, you know, what are you going to do to bring harmony, federal-provincial harmony? He said, there's no secret about provincial harmony. He said, you just give the premiers everything they want and you will have federal-provincial harmony. But that's not why people elected a federal government. And I think we see the same thing today. I mean, the premiers coming out to their benefit, 2 hours of not having any background negotiations going on for months leading up to this. It literally was like, we're led to believe, was just put on the table and saying, okay, what do you think of that? Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't like it? Okay, well, that's all there is. On the other hand, you know, the federal government is talking about wanting outcomes. And this is, again, an argument that goes back to every federal-provincial discussion about healthcare, and that is, the federal government says, you know, we actually have to see some results. This is a lot of money. And the provinces are saying, no, that's our business, hands off. So let's default to the only people that matter in all of this. What do Canadians think about all this? Actually, Canadians think that throwing a lot more money at healthcare is not going to fix it. They would agree with the federal health minister. Mm-hmm. So I think there's going to be a certain amount of sympathy here of Canadians towards the federal plan, which is at least a plan. It's not just talking about big numbers and budgets. It's actually talking about people's health care. It's talking about mental health. It's talking about home care. These are things that are affecting millions of Canadians now, and I think they will get a sympathetic ear to that.
So, Lindsay, is it a jurisdictional issue? The province says, hey, under the Constitution, we deliver health care, and they're trying to tell us how to spend our money. Is that what the nub of this is, or is it really bottom line driven?
I think that seems to be part of the argument and the pushback that we saw today. But also, you know, the style of governance between Mr. Harper and Mr. Trudeau, especially when it came to health care, you know, it was very easy for the previous government to you know, keep going with that 6% and say, we don't want to have anything to do with healthcare delivery. That's not our style. That's up to the provinces. They were very specific about, you know, maintaining those jurisdictions. But when it comes to Mr. Trudeau and the Liberal government, they did make very ambitious commitments, whether it was to home care, you know, mental health, pharmacare, and other things. So they do want to play in that space, and they're willing to pony up big money. And there was, you know, financially substantive amounts that were put on the table today for the provinces that I do think would have been quite helpful. So hopefully that is going to be part of the conversation moving forward, and that consideration is given to, you know, the fact that they were offering, what was it, over $11 billion for home care. So
over 10 years. Over 10, that's only a billion a year.
That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
I don't know. All right. I'm going to just stop you there. We're going to go ahead and find out what really happened here. Eric Hoskins is standing by. He's the Ontario Minister of Health, and he joins us live from the Chateau Laurier meeting site. Dr. Hoskins, no deal. What was the problem here? Is it bottom line driven, territorial driven, or the fact that you just weren't consulted enough in advance? I don't think he's hearing me. So I'll ask the same question to you, Michelle Austin. No, I won't.
I'm ready. No, but all of you,
yeah. Live her television. This sort of stuff happens all the time.
Yeah. You want me to go up?
I want you to tell me, though, is this a jurisdictional fight?
No, it's, well, you know, if you're conservative, it's a jurisdictional issue. That's part of it. But there's, as I've said before on the show, there's no problem the Liberals don't feel that they can solve, right? Federally speaking, they want to be involved. But I think the bottom line really is dollars here, because healthcare is expensive. The federal government has a lot of things that it wants to pay for. The provincial government, it makes up 40% of their budget. This is about dollars. And you know, there's some, a little bit of negotiating tactics sprinkled in there, but this is an expensive commitment that everybody has, and they want to be able to fund it from the single taxpayer who's paying for it.
Greg, is there any plan B here? Like, the provinces say no to a deal, the feds say we're not going to move. What happens next?
Well, again, let's default to the people that matter, the people who get this health care and want it out there. I think what Canadians would probably like them to do, and which I think will probably start to happen, is at the very least the provinces need to come back and make a case for what they're going to spend the money on and satisfy everybody in the room that they actually have a plan other than we just need more money. This right. whole thing, I think the federal health minister said it nicely. He said, I think most people understand that we are not going to solve what ails healthcare by just opening the federal purse all the time.
Okay.
So it's not just more money, it's how you spend it that matters.
We're going to try this again. Don't go anywhere in case we have another failure. We're going to go see if Eric Hoskins is the Ontario Minister of Health, and he's joining us from the Chateau Laurier. Dr. Hoskins, I hope you can hear me now. I just want to get your thoughts what caused this breakdown? Is this just bottom line driven, or are there other factors at play?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as an impasse. I think that today was really an important first step. For the first time, the federal government put their proposal formally on the table for discussion. We did the same. The proposal that was discussed between the premiers and the prime minister about 10 days ago, we put that on the table. We haven't really had an opportunity to discuss either proposal together in detail. So we've asked for a process. The premiers have asked this afternoon for a first minister's meeting. We need to take the time. This is so important to Canadians. And interestingly enough, this is the 50th anniversary to the day of Medicare Act becoming law, getting royal assent. We need to look at the time forward in as equally a serious manner. It can't be a one-off. It can't be a discussion that takes place over 2 or 3 hours in a single day. It needs to be a process. That's what we're asking for.
Do you believe the federal government has picked the right priorities to target funding at? Specifically, you know, they've got the mental health push and the home care push. Are those priorities your priorities, or do you think you could use the money they're putting on the table to better effect in health care?
Well, those are certainly Ontario's priorities and their priorities across this country. So we're increasing each year our investments in home care by 5%, $250 million new dollars this year. We're increasing our investments in mental health as well. The problem is that these are outside of the Canada Health Transfer, and they can't, those important priorities investments, which are everybody supports, they can't come at the expense of sustaining our existing healthcare system. We need to make sure that we've got enough funds to invest, continue investing in our hospitals, to continue investing in our frontline healthcare workers, all the other elements of the healthcare system. And the problem with the federal proposal is that if we were to accept it, over the next 10 years, the proportion of their funding, the percentage funding that they provide, which is only about 20%, that will actually decline further, so that their contribution as a percentage of the whole will be even less than it is today. So we're simply asking them to follow the evidence, the science. We've got the Parliamentary Budget Officer, we've got the Conference Board of Canada saying that the amount of the federal investment needs to be more than what was proposed today.
Help me with math, because math was my downfall. So does the 3.5% bump they were talking about, plus the $11 billion over 10 years, if you add those two together, would that equal 5.5% or 6%, or does that still fall short?
It falls short. In fact, over the next 5 years, it would equal just over 4%. But the important aspect of this is that we're only talking about the federal contribution. So again, like an escalator, which is what they're talking about, of 3.5% or 4%, it's only on the roughly 20% that the federal government is contributing. So that's less than a percent that would actually be applied to the growth of the healthcare budget in Ontario or elsewhere. So the provinces and territories, we still and will continue to fund 80% of the health that is provided, the health services provided across the country. We need to get this right for the patients that depend on us, not just for home care and for mental health, but for across the board, so that we can continue to reduce wait times, we can address an aging and growing population, those things that are most important. So we're not saying, we didn't take anything off the table. We didn't end the discussions. What we've asked for is a continuation of the discussions with great urgency, involving the premiers and the prime minister directly as necessary in the coming weeks ahead, looking at the two formal proposals and actually reaching an accommodation and a consensus on what's best for Canadians.
Dr. Hoskins, what happens if the feds just dig in their heels? I mean, can you just walk away and say, we're not taking your money? Or what's the plan B from the province's point of view?
Well, our plan B is the same as our plan A. It's to continue to work in a partnership, in a collaborative way with the federal government. I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful. Certainly when you look at what this federal government, the Trudeau government, has done in strengthening that partnership and collaboration with provinces and territories, I think if there's no better place than here. Healthcare is the most important thing to Canadians to ensure that they can live full, high-quality lives. We owe it to them, federal, provincial, and territorial, to spend a little bit more time, now that we have some proposals for the first time in front of us, to make sure we get this right. And all we're asking for is to follow the science and the evidence, Conference Board of Canada, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, that say that what the federal government has put on the table thus far is insufficient. It will result in a decline from about 23% to 20% of the federal contribution to health care. It will result in about $30 billion less being invested in health care as well from the federal government. We can't afford that, especially at this moment in time, and especially as we're looking forward to the next 50 years of Medicare and health care in this country, of universal health care.
Right. Last question then. You know, this is a government, the federal government, that consults and consults and consults some more. Are you surprised you got to the table and there was no, hadn't been enough consulting, that there was a failure to communicate that led to most of this sort of breakdown, if you will?
Well, we've been communicating. Ontario has certainly vigorously over the course of the last year. I know the Prime Minister himself in September of last year reached out to the provinces and territories and expressed his strong desire to work in a collaborative fashion. So again, that's why I'm hopeful and optimistic. I think that we've got two proposals in front of us now. We need to actually work through those in a collaborative way in the coming days and weeks. We're prepared to do the heavy lifting and the hard work together with our federal partners. Those priorities that they've identified, there's no question those are important priorities. But we need to look at the whole healthcare system. We need to make sure that it continues to provide those necessary services to Canadians, not just this year, but going forward. And that takes a little bit of time. I think that I'm optimistic that the Prime Minister understands that, and I'm optimistic that we'll get back to work on that pathway to reaching a collaborative consensus.
Okay, we'll see if he turns into Santa instead of Scrooge. All right, thank you very much, Eric Hoskins. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, in a world away, in a different topic entirely, Russia's ambassador to Turkey was gunned down while being interviewed on television this morning. It has put the entire region on edge. We will get the latest from Turkey's ambassador to Canada right after these messages. Welcome back. Well, onto news which may have far-reaching diplomatic consequences in the Syrian conflict and beyond. Russia's ambassador to Turkey was fatally shot today while attending a photo exhibit in the Turkish capital. And a warning, the video we're going to show you may be disturbing to some viewers. You'll hear the gunshots that fatally wounded the ambassador, and you'll also see him moments before he was killed. Again, a warning to our viewers, this is graphic. Yeah, the ambassador Andrei Karlov was making a speech at the gallery when the assailant entered and opened fire. Three other people were reportedly hurt. The gunman was identified as an Ankara policeman and was later killed by security forces. Well, for his thoughts, let's bring in the Turkish ambassador to Canada. Selçuk Ünal is in the studio. Welcome to the program, Ambassador. Nice to have you with us. Have you got any new information on who was behind this at all?
Not yet, of course. It's a very saddening, very sorry situation, which we utterly condemn. It's understood that he is a two-year service member of the anti-riot police force. He's 22 years old, male, as it's seen, and he was not on duty on that day. He entered to the premises via using his police identity card. Mm-hmm. And, you know, committed this savage terrorist act, unfortunately. We are so sad today, of course. Yeah. We immediately started an investigation. His immediate family was taken under custody for detention and questioning. And we also announced that we will jointly investigate this issue, this attack with the Russian authorities and experts.
Right. I think your foreign affairs minister is actually flown already to Moscow.
He was destined to travel there for a joint tripartite foreign ministers meeting with Iran and Russia to discuss the humanitarian situation in Aleppo. As you might know, our foreign minister was in direct contact with his Russian counterpart in the last couple of days, maybe a dozen times they spoke to address the situation. He did, like the Prime Minister and the President of Turkey, made statements of condolences. And we said that we will be jointly investigating this matter.
It's sort of ironic in a sad way that, you know, Russia and Syria, or Russia and Turkey were starting to collaborate a little bit more on dealing with Syria. Do you think this will hinder that relationship from developing?
I do. Actually, both Turkish high-level officials, as well as, I understand, President Putin, made statements to that end, saying that this is a provocation or act to undermine the Russian-Turkish relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not because our foreign minister was destined to travel to Moscow, but as I said, we have been redeveloping this relationship for a long time, as well as coordinating the humanitarian situation in Syria. That's why we, of course, wish it will not affect the relationship. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we are very sorry and we regret what happened today, as we condemn the other two terror incidents in Germany and in Switzerland today.
Yeah, President Erdogan's actually been negotiating for the civilians to get out of Aleppo.
That's correct, yes.
This doesn't hurt that process, you don't think?
I don't think so, because it was stopped by other actors on the ground. Mm-hmm. It has actually started, as you might know, a couple of days ago. Then it was sort of undermined. But after Turkish-Russian coordination, as we have made public, this process of evacuation of civilians from the city has restarted. Actually, yesterday and today, more than 20,000 people have been evacuated towards different areas of Syria.
Final question, I guess. Has this been designated a terrorist attack of some kind?
I think it's very early to say, because there is a lot of information going on. When we want to, let's say, take out speculation from information. So that's why we will start an immediate investigation of the matter. But at the end, as a country who lost its many diplomats to terrorism, we consider this act as a terrorism act.
Okay, well, it's certainly aimed at trying to destabilize, and let's hope it doesn't. All right, Ambassador, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And turning now to Germany, what a terrible day it's been there, where a truck plowed through one of Berlin's many outdoor Christmas markets. German police there are saying that at least 9 people have been killed, another 50 injured. Police arrested a man near the scene. A passenger inside the truck is dead, although it's unclear how that person may have died. Police are not confirming if this is a terror attack at this time, but they have issued a tweet asking Berlin residents to stay home. I'm going to follow this story closely, and we'll bring you more details as they come in. All right, on a happier note, it's the time of the year when we focus on 5 Canadian political figures who have had the greatest impact on the landscape. And after much discussion and without any gender goals in mind, we're pleased to announce that 4 of them are women. Canada's Environment Minister is our first power player of the year. Her feature interview is after these messages. Please stay with us. Okay, a year ago this month, she was leading Canada's delegation to the Paris Climate Change Conference. This month, she got a large consensus amongst provinces to meet those emission reduction targets. For cleaning up the complicated environment file, we're pleased to welcome our first Power Play of the Year. That's Environment and Climate Change Minister Catherine McKenna. Drum roll, please.
Great to be here.
There's no prize, no money, nothing of any kind here. I guess you've done a lot. I mean, whether it's the coal phase out or getting the first ministers together, I mean, is there a highlight?
You know what? A highlight was when everyone was sitting with the Prime Minister on the stage, all the premiers with the National Indigenous, the leaders of the National Indigenous organizations, mm-hmm. and everyone had come together, and it was 1 year after the Paris Agreement. A lot of work went into getting the climate deal by a lot of people. And even for the few provinces that weren't quite there yet, we worked really hard and we got agreement on most of the different parts of our climate agreement. And it's just great that we were able to do it. It was pretty daunting, I think, at the beginning, but just really proud that everyone stood together because we recognize climate change is a huge issue and we all need to act.
Coupling that with the coal phase out, is realistically the train in motion actually meet those Paris targets? Is there something that could stop it, a change in government? I mean, you're not going to be in power until 2030. Could something like the U.S. happen where it gets derailed somewhere along the track?
Yeah, so what I've always said is that the Paris Agreement was a signal to the markets. And you've seen companies say, we're moving to a low-carbon future, and that's where they're investing. And so I don't think so. I think you're going to see changes of government, of course. But I think that everyone recognizes that this is a real opportunity. Certainly everyone in Canada recognizes that. They might have a bit of a different vision across the country about how, you know, they want to tackle reducing emissions. But the fact we were able to come together on some pretty tough issues, because it's a pretty comprehensive agreement. It's not just about pricing pollution. It's about coal phase out. It's about how do we have more energy efficient buildings and homes. It's a big piece. It's pretty amazing. And I think that you're just going to see new technology, innovation, opportunities for Canadians to export what we do, the solutions we find here. So I think it's going to improve. We're going to increase our ability to reduce emissions, and we're going to position ourselves really well.
You're back from China this month. China's always pictured to some people as sort of the emissions apocalypse over there. They can't breathe in Beijing, huge health warnings and that sort of stuff. Do you see hope that they'll actually get with the program, no matter what the U.S. does, and we'll talk about them in a minute, that China will actually clean up its act? Or is
China is with the program, partly because of what you said. The air quality is a really big concern there. But they showed a leadership role with the Obama administration in terms of having a serious climate plan. They've got a cap on emissions from coal-fired plants. They also are having the largest carbon market next year. So they're committed to acting, and they want us to continue to act together. So I think there's a real opportunity to work with them. I was there with the Clean Tech Mission. They're very keen on Canadian solutions, on soil remediation, air quality, water quality. So I think it's a huge opportunity for us to work together. Of course, there's a lot of work to do. They also want to provide electricity to their citizens. But I think that they're very serious about climate action. And the minister who I worked very closely with, the climate negotiator, he said they're all in.
Let's quickly talk Donald Trump. You've got a new president coming in that doesn't sound as green as President Obama leaving. I know you probably want to put a lump of coal in his stocking, but how do you think Canada is going to deal as the mouse beside the elephant, and the elephant's going back into the mud and getting dirty, and we're trying to clean up our act?
So once again, it goes back to the market. It's the opportunity. So I'm pretty sure that the new administration wants the same things we want. Want jobs, want to grow our economy, want to create new, want to invest in infrastructure. And we've heard that from the president-elect, and that's what we want too. So I will certainly be making the economic case that this is an opportunity to work together. When it comes to energy security, there's a lot of opportunities. We already sell a lot of clean power, hydro, to the United States. And I think working together, we have an opportunity to grow our economy. We're not always going to agree on everything, but that's okay. You know what? We have a strong view in Canada that we need to be taking action to tackle climate change. It's an opportunity.
Was it hard for you as the environment minister to sit around the cabinet and caucus table when the pipelines were being approved? Is that, did you find it hard to square that with what you were trying to do?
So I've always said that this is a transition, that we're not getting out of fossil fuels overnight. We know we need to get out of coal quickly. We know we're moving to a low carbon future. But we also need to be thoughtful about what we're doing. And if we can't demonstrate that we can grow our economy, that we can ensure that everyone benefits from a cleaner future, then I lose the whole climate plan, the Prime Minister loses the climate plan, that people start worrying just about, you know, the economy and jobs. And that's why I think our approach made sense. We're very mindful of emissions and the impact of major projects on emissions. Now, with pipelines, the oil and gas will get to market. It's more a price and a demand issue. But no, I mean, I felt that I supported our government's position. I thought it was the right thing to do. We'd worked very closely with Alberta. Alberta has a very serious climate plan, 100 megaton cap on emissions. Every project has to fit within that cap. And as I said, like, I'm not in this game to leave anyone behind.
Right.
That includes energy workers.
Final question. You've got a very strong sense of work-life balance. Do you still get home every night for dinner, except for maybe Tuesdays?
You know, it's really hard. That's the hardest part of this job.
Yeah.
I could get really emotional about it because it's really, really tough. And, you know, it's really hard being a parent.
Yeah.
And a lot of people travel a lot further than I do. It's just there's not a lot of divide. When you live in and work in Ottawa Center, it's hard to get away from it. But I try really hard, and I try to turn off a phone. I'm not always amazing at it. But I'm going to be taking some holidays with my kids. And I'm going to continue working at it because it's really important. And I've heard so much positive response from moms and dads and all sorts of folks who are saying, you know, I'm trying to do that too. And so if I can try to be a role model and stay true to that, then I think I'll have accomplished something really important.
Good for you. Well, you've done a lot in a year, and if you can keep that balance more or less in sync, I think that's quite commendable. Catherine McKenna, thanks for coming in, and congratulations on being our Power Player of the Year.
Thank you.
All right, let's continue with our cross-Canada checkup on the regions and in the various provinces to see what's happened in 2016 there. It's been a relatively quiet year in the usually stormy Quebec political realm. Let's find out what's churning below that surface with Paul Journet. He is a writer with La Presse. He joins us from Montreal. Paul, Premier Couillard, he's saying he saved the province from fiscal ruin, and that's his greatest achievement of the year. Did he?
Well, one thing for sure is that when he came into power, the province wanted to get back to fiscal balance, but it had failed for 3 years in a row. And no matter what party would have gone into power, they all had the same plan. The big, bad, hard to make the population swallow taxes. And Premier Couillard had sort of the ingrateful task of having the one who had to do it. But he